Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Lewis and Lucas podcast. I'm half your podcast, Lucas. With me, as always, is Lewis. How are you today, sir?
Excellent. Doing excellent here on a
Good.
spring morning. So
We got snow over in our Wisconsin spring. It takes forever,
that's
this part of the world, to get out of winter.
builds character though. We're Midwestern boys are the real men.
Exactly. So I said this is the Lewis and Lucas podcast, and actually, as of today, that's no longer our podcast. We are officially rebranding our podcast. The title is Let's Build a Christian Nation. We've been engaged in a lot of conversations about what our world looks like today, the many different problems that we face, and how Christianity would fix a lot of these national and global issues. So it just kind of made sense to showcase where our focus is and just call the podcast, look, hey, let's build a Christian nation. Let's talk about problems and we'll talk about solutions.
Yeah, nice. And we did not call it Christian nationalism, even though there was some debate on that. We want to talk
Yeah,
about
let's talk about
talk
that for
about
a
that, but
second. So Christian nationalism, it actually started as I first started hearing that as a pejorative a couple years ago from liberals who accused Christians that were getting involved in political matters as Christian nationalists. You know,
And
ever
it
since.
got lumped together with just general nationalism, white nationalism, like those three phrases were kind of used all the time right after Trump got elected, right? So,
That's what I was going to say. The Trump. So as soon as you stick nationalism on something, you're supposed, oh, gross, ew, yeah, I don't, whatever blah nationalism, I'm supposed to hate that. That's evil.
it's been a trick for the last 50 years is anything that the left doesn't like, they try to attach to Hitler in some way. So there's, to the extent that they can make you Hitler adjacent,
Yeah, so like
they've destroyed
nationalism,
your effort, right?
fascism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I personally like the term Christian, it Christian nationalist. I understand that it's a pejorative, but it's like, you know what? I am a Christian and I think our nation should be a Christian nation. So yeah, I'm a Christian nationalist. And in a
Yeah.
sense that historically that's how a lot of Protestant denominations got their start, right? So like Baptists, you know, they were like, oh, those are the guys that baptize everybody all the time. And so they kind of just, that's a pejorative. Now it's the name of a very big part of the Protestant tradition. Puritans, oh, those guys care about being super pure and, you know, they never have any fun and blah. Well, now they're the Puritans, and that's how we remember them now, you know. So in the sense, I feel like Christian nationalism started in that same tradition. Start as a pejorative, but it is really a way to be like for you to stand up and just be like, look, yeah, I am a Christian. I think our nation should be a Christian nation. You know, and here's where I stand. You want to all the negative connotations that might come with taking such a stand? Okay, fine, you know.
And if everyone understood it that way, I'd fully embrace it. And I agree with everything you said in terms of obviously I think Christians nations should be led by Christianity, and I think Christianity is true, and I think really bringing our laws into accord with the divine law is ultimately the only thing you can do. Like, the alternative is for your laws to be out of accord with the divine law, which seems like not something a country should aspire to do. Now, with all that being said, the reason I have hesitation about the phrase is, number one, like you said, is new. And I feel like, yeah, it could ultimately be defined in a good way, but in 5 years, everyone could understand Christian nationalism in a certain way. And then they could kind of retrospectively say, hey, Lewis and Lucas, those guys were Christian nationalists. And it's like, we'd be like, wait a second, we didn't agree to what the new definition is. So, like, there's some part of me that's like, it's a new phrase, it doesn't have a good definition. At least in the
public. And then we just lost our access to the new central bank digital currency.
Exactly. And then I've got my social credit scores all screwed up. So that's like part of my concern is like adopting a definition before that definition's actually been defined. Another concern I have is the nationalistic part of it. Nationalism as a kind of philosophy is a fairly recent philosophy. So nationalism, the nation state, is amazingly recent. So like we think of Germany, for example, as a nation. Germany didn't exist before 1870. We think of Italy as a nation. I can't remember what year they came, but it was even later than Germany, I think. Like it, a lot of what we now describe as these old nations, and we talk about the Romans invading Germany, or we talk about the Romans sending missionaries to England, they weren't nations that they were sending their missionaries to. They're regions, and they were a collection of city-states, and sometimes there was a king that kind of had rule over a certain area, but generally speaking, it wasn't like an organized nation in our modern conception. And so that's where, like, even though I don't think that's your intent, that's not my intent, I don't think that's the public necessarily perception of it, but just including that nationalistic aspect of it where, you know, I don't know, maybe it would be good to go back to some kind of city-state structure. Like, you know, we were talking to Aaron last week and like that's what he thought. And like there's some part of me that's like, yeah, that might be a better way to do it than through nationalism proper. But I guess now to go to my definition, if I was going to call myself a Christian nationalist, it wouldn't necessarily be that I support nationalism so much as I think every nation, to the extent that it exists, whether it's a city state, whether it's a giant empire like the United States, should fall under Christianity. So, you know, I guess it really depends on how you define it, but it's, those are my reservations with the phrase Christian nationalism. So.
Sure. And those are good reasons and a good point too about the creation of the modern nation state. Now you would expect most Christians to support the idea that our nation, as it's currently designed, to be Christian, but you would be wrong. As I've been learning, I've been thinking about this. It seems like there's two Christians who don't support the idea that Christian nationalism or the idea that our nation should be a Christian nation. There's two types of Christians who don't agree with that. Number one is like the liberal kind of like they're the more like we interviewed Jacob Brunton before, right? That there's that kind of the Enlightenment principles that our nation was founded upon, the secularism, the religious plurality. Those are all things because, you know, as they'll tell you, the Bible.
Yeah, the libertarian view of,
yeah,
you know, let religion kind of be in its own sphere, set up minimalistic laws, you know, at the government level and let people kind of choose their own religion, choose their own direction, and keep the government out of it, basically.
Yep. Yep. And so there's that. And then there's the sort of this pietism. And a lot of Baptists who don't support Christian nationalism or the idea that we should be a Christian nation fall into this sort of pietism of like, well, Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. It's the next world. And, you know, the rapture, the millennial kingdom, you know, that's coming. So there's no point in us trying to build a Christian nation because it's not going to work anyway because we're sinful people and Jesus is coming back. So don't even bother. So I feel like those are like the two types of Christians that don't support the idea of a Christian nation.
Right, right. Yeah, no. And that Baptist tradition goes back, if you look at like Amish and Mennonite which are also part of the kind of that same stream of thought.
Yeah.
They are extremely not of this world. That's the idea behind the whole Amish thing, is like, don't serve as police officers, don't serve as politicians, don't campaign to change. Like, basically, your job is to create a Christian community and let the world burn, in a sense. and to the degree, not necessarily thinking that that will save you from oppression, right? So the Amish have a very deep belief that their actions will cause them to be oppressed. They believe that their community will lead to their, you know, the outside hating them, which maybe it will. But so not necessarily thinking they can build a perfect community on earth, but instead just to live peaceably, to allow non-Christians to do whatever non-Christians want to do, and within their community try and model Christ, right? So that's a long history there. And that's when you think of kind of the way the church relates to the state, or I guess to the world would be a better phrase, but there's a couple of different ways, right? Like one of the Baptists / Anabaptists / Mennonites / Amish, they would have kind of a Christ against the world, that the world is bad, the world's, you know, perdition, and all you can do is try and stay separate from it as best you can. You stay separate from the world. And then there's a kind of the polar opposite of that is like a Rush Dooney, Douglas Wilson, arguably Tim Keller. I don't agree with Tim Keller's take on it, but I think he would say this is his view, is that Christ transforming the world, right? So the idea is not that the world is bad and going to hell and we just need to try and stay a million miles away from it, so much as Christ is transforming the world, trying to make it a better place, trying to improve your community, trying to you know, help the slave, help the poor, help the weak, you know, going to kind of this transformative element of the gospel. And those are very different views, right? And
yeah,
a lot of Baptists hold to that Christ against the world. But I would argue a good historical view. I don't think the church has historically taught it. I don't think it's a biblical view. I don't think,
right.
I don't think it's, nor do it from a practical standpoint, do I think it's realistic? So I don't know. That's.
And I would argue too, it's an eschatological aspect of it as well. So eschatology, when people study the end times, that's the fancy theological word, eschatology. So like the traditional Baptist, premillennial, you know, the world is going to get worse and worse and worse and worse, but that's okay because that means that Christ's return is going to be right around the corner, right? So like the rapture, if you watched any of the Left Behind movies, the rapture's right around the corner.
Which is great, great cinema, regardless of the theology. It's just beautiful, beautiful acting.
You know, I haven't watched the, like, I remember the old ones, like, that came out, like, in the 90s or 2000s, but then Nicolas Cage did a movie.
Yeah, I never saw the Nick Cage one. I'd love to. I love Nick Cage.
Oh, man, yeah. But yeah, so if you believe that, hey, the world is getting worse and worse, and that's actually kind of a good thing because that means Christ is going to come. Yeah. It's imminent. Then it's going to be hard to work with those types of Christians to try and build a Christian nation.
Right, right. So I think what the pushback from secular culture is on this is, hey, listen, we did Christian nationalism before, and it was called the Middle Ages, and witches got burned, and people were being getting their hands chopped off and stuck in blocks and slaves and blah blah blah, and like Christian nationalism has been tried and failed. And so what would your response to that be? I have my own answer.
For sure. I know you do. Yeah. So I would just quickly say that's a gross mischaracterization of the history. of medieval, like we, and the scholarship around medieval history has gotten a lot better in the past couple of years. You know, we think of the Enlightenment period as, you know, oh, we need to stop butchering each other and we need to stop, you know, and actually, you know, like the French Revolution, I would argue, is a culmination of all those Enlightenment principles and the wholesale slaughter that happens if you don't, like, hey, we have this new society, super diverse, you can be whatever. Like, how can such a tolerant society slaughter so many of their own intellectuals and people? That's what happened in the French Revolution. So and this idea that I've argued before on our podcast, like King Alfred the Great, the first king of a unified England, right? As you said before, in England, there was all these little fiefdoms and city states, whatever. So King Alfred was able to drive the Viking horde that had swallowed England. King Alfred was able to fight them and drive them back out and Christianized the entire island. And part of what he did, his greatest contribution to Western civilization, I think, is the Sea Dombach, the Doom Book, which became the English common law. And in the beginning, the preface of this legal document is a translation of Exodus chapters 20 and 21, which is where the Ten Commandments and a bunch of other laws in the Old Testament are given. And then he has this big explanation after that translation. There's this big explanation of why him and his advisors used Exodus and the Mosaic law to build English common law. And it's because they're Christians and because God has given us his law to show us how we should get along. And so he didn't take the Mosaic law and it's like, okay, we're going to start executing people who work on the Sabbath. They took the principles, the underlying principles of the law, as they understood them, they looked at English law that already existed. And if the law that already existed meshed with God's law, great, we can keep that law. If it didn't, it had to change. And if there were things that God's law promoted that were not in the English common law, okay, well, now we have to make accommodations to that. And this is how this is the reason why we have lots of different things that we enjoy in the West that are absent from other parts of the world. Like the idea that you should have a trial by a jury of your peers, that came from King Alfred's understanding of Mosaic law. We have the witness standard, right? You can't just have one person accuse you of something and then you get punished for, like, you have to have multiple witnesses that see you do something. So people, I've seen people be like, well, if we bring back God's law, we're going to start, how do we prevent somebody from getting executed for a crime that they didn't commit? Because the witness standard actually comes from the Bible. That's how we got it. And there's so many things. The idea, like we've talked before about unlimited liability, that liability as a legal principle is made very, very, very clear in the Mosaic law. And we use the concept as it's described in Mosaic law. And that's how we have it here today in the West. So that's what I would say to someone who's like, oh, Christian nationalism have been tried and failed, therefore we can't use God's law.
Yeah. And that's a good answer. And I just to add to what you said, like a big part of me is like, we have always used God's law, and that's what, like, you go back and you say, okay, they were, you know, burning witches in the Middle Ages or whatever, or they were doing this bad thing at this certain point in time in history. And my answer to that is like, okay, number one, we do bad things all the time. You mentioned, you know, whether it's as recently as communism, the world wars, carpet bombing cities, whatever. We've done horrible things, not to mention abortion, not to mention like
right. The
craziness that we're doing with some of the trans stuff, et cetera. So like
butchering healthy children.
We do bad things. Furthermore, like if you take any point in time, you take Christendom and you compare it to some other culture. So rather than comparing it to your idea of perfection, right? And it's funny, everybody always thinks they live in the perfection. Like, my modern liberalism is the perfect time. You know, like, but just compare it to other societies at the time. So compare, take 13th century England and compare it to what was going on in Mesoamerica at the time, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And, or you compare it to what was going on in Islam, or you compare it to what was going on. And all of a sudden, it starts to look like a nice, free, beautiful place, right? And certainly better than ancient Rome that used to rule Europe, right? So when you look at Middle Ages Europe and you compare it to what came before Christianity, Rome, I mean, a lot of people have this rosy picture of Rome, but Rome was a brutal place. More slaves than citizens. I mean, just like widespread slavery, brutal sex slave trade, no rules to protect the slaves. Constant state of war, wars that the Middle Ages never saw the scale of some of these wars, where they would send hundreds of thousands versus hundreds of thousands. In the Middle Ages, a grand battle would be 10,000 times 10, you know, 10,000 people fighting 10,000 people or whatever. Like, that was a giant battle in the Middle Ages. In ancient Rome, the wars were like full scale modern wars almost. They would execute criminals in the most brutal, horrible way they could possibly do. Like, the crucifixion, a lot of people think that's unique to Jesus. That was a common way for them to deal with troublemakers. Like, just if you were an escaped slave, if you were in any way rebelling against the government, crucifixion was a very common thing back then that they used to do. So the brutality and horror of ancient Rome, and compare what following God's law did to the people of Europe. Just take that as your test case. And the Middle Ages is a giant improvement from what it was in ancient Rome. So, and like you said, with King Alfred and other kings, you take Charlemagne or whoever, and they were using the law of God to try and make the world better. And yeah, it wasn't a perfect paradise, but guess what? In 1,000 years, they won't think United States in 21st century is a perfect paradise either, believe me.
Exactly, exactly. But,
nonetheless, to the extent that improvements were made, those improvements almost always were based on reflections on Christianity, reflections on God's word, reflections on what a Christian nation should look like. And I think, you know, in my mind, that should always be our goal of, you know, do these laws reflect, are these laws getting us to, as a nation, to where we should be going from a Christian perspective? And, you know, I don't know, kind of like Peter said with Jesus, you know, Jesus said, you're going to leave. And Peter said, to whom would we go? Like, so if we're not following the laws of God, we're not seeking to become more aligned with God's divine law, what do we use to follow, you know, what kind of standard do we use to set our laws?
Ding, ding. This is the million-dollar question. If not God's standard, then whose standard? So like, well, what, you know, we need to be super diverse. We need to understand that there are other, well, it's like Christians who talk that way about like, well, it's almost like they're saying there's many ways to skin a cat. There's other ways to do justice. And I was like, there's other religions that have other opinions about law and justice. But if you believe that, if you believe in Jesus, he is the only way, the truth, and the life. Those who love him have to keep his commandments. And every single human being will eventually be judged based on whether or not they obeyed him. Why wouldn't you want to impose that on your nation? Like, if you truly loved your neighbors, wouldn't you want them to live in a Christian nation? You know, why do we think that thousands of immigrants pour into this country year after year after year? It's because there's things that we have that came about, I would argue, because our ancestors were Christians and gave us these different legal institutions that allow us to enjoy the wealth and prosperity that we have today that's absent from other parts of the world. The other thing I would say too about the, like the medieval period, like the witches burning thing, that's an area where God's law was not followed. If they had employed the witness standard, right? Because like you'd hear stories about how someone was accused of witchcraft, so we need to see if, you know, throw her in a lake to see if she floats, or like they had all these weird trials to see whether or not
do those work? I thought that worked.
No, okay. they don't. It's and those have pagan origins, right? There's nothing in the Bible that talks about using those types of trials to determine guilt. With one exception, I'm not going to get into it right now, but the witness standard was not employed in those cases where, like, oh my gosh, that was horrible. So she didn't float, therefore she drowned. And they're like, oh, look, see?
The phrase witch hunt kind of implies zero standard of witness, right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah, kind of like we use in a modern sense, a witch hunt would be you just start accusing people randomly with minimal or zero evidence, right?
Right. And that is not God's law at all.
Right, right. And the other thing I point out with the witches thing is like, I touched on this in my book a little bit, but this idea that witchcraft and paganism was all fake and was harmless, and there was these innocent women off in the woods and, you know, maybe a little crazy or whatever, and they just were hunting after them.
Just goofing around.
It's worth noting that paganism did human sacrifice. They killed often babies as part of the sacrifice. This was documented in a lot of these cases. There's various literature from the Middle Ages where they go out and they look and they interview these people. So there was a lot of cases, and I don't know what percent or whatever, but there was a lot of cases where there was legitimate, dark, horrible stuff going on. Maybe you don't execute those people, but there was a lot of people that deserved to at least be in prison for a lot of that stuff. And I'm take away any specific case, but just generally speaking, it was a dark practice. That paganism of the Middle Ages that they were trying to stamp out had a lot of darkness to it and a lot of evil to it. And so in modern day, it's like the witches are the heroes and the witch hunters are the evil people. Often it was the opposite.
Exactly. And your book, which if you caught that, so like the last episode we did with Aaron, I recommended that again because like drugs came up, of course. So you're talking to libertarians. They're like, man, we should, you just got to be cool with the drugs, man. People just want to get high. And and he says, you know, Bible doesn't say anything about it. I'm like, au contraire. Read Lewis's book.
I used to think the Bible doesn't say anything about it either, but it does say a lot about it. So check out The Return of the Dragon. Now available on Amazon. It definitely says a lot. And that's a great example. I think the error of libertarianism, the major hole of libertarianism, and Aaron, I thought, tried to do a pretty good job of explaining how libertarianism could be consistent with this. But I'll restate kind of what I said to him and what I think is the major problem with libertarianism is this idea of the individual. Libertarianism is very much based on each individual is an individual at atomic unit that should be allowed to live their own life how they want to live their own life. And the government and other people need to just leave that person alone and let them pursue happiness. And happiness is not necessarily a feeling, but just their wisdom, their knowledge, where they want to go in life. Let them pursue happiness in autonomy. Don't get involved unless they invite you in or whatever. But ultimately, they should have the right to their property. They should have the right to not have their actions infringed upon. And essentially, they should be free so long as they don't violate the autonomy of other people. So
it's like hyper individualism.
Right. Yeah. So I should be able to live my own life freely as long as I don't violate you living your own life freely. So it's this idea that we're all individuals. The problem with that is we're not, right? My actions influence your actions. My wearing a dress and showing up at drag shows or whatever is going to influence your children. It's going to influence the community. It's going to influence teenagers. It's going to influence. So like those, my actions, my, you know, going out and doing drugs or whatever, like my decisions that I make from a moral and from just a habitual standpoint, those do influence people. I'm not an individual. I am a part of a community. I am part of the city that I'm in. I'm part of the circle of friends that I'm in. I'm part of the school system my kids are in. I'm part of the workplace that I work in. Like, I am a part of that, and my actions influence people, and we all see it, right? Like, we see when one person, you know, for example, in the 1990s, Howard Stern got big. And he was real kind of crass and dirty and would tell dirty jokes and kind of had that libertarian attitude of like, hey, don't like it, turn it off or whatever. But what I noticed with Howard Stern is that kids started to joke like him. So like when I was in school, kids would joke like he would joke. They'd tell jokes. You know, his sense of humor started to bleed through them. So his decision to tell crass jokes or whatever on the radio absolutely did affect the community. And it affected not only little kids, you know, in school, it affected me who didn't even listen to Howard Stern. It does have an effect. He's not an autonomous individual. He's someone that had a profound effect on a lot of people. And that's true to a lesser degree of everybody, right? So like if your uncle, you know that he's sleeping with a parade of women every month, that becomes a normalized behavior for you. And you're like, oh, Uncle Joe or John or whoever, like all of a sudden started, you know, having these affairs all the time. Maybe it's normal. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's not a behavior that, you know, so, you know, what kind of in a honor and shame society, like you go back to the Bible times, and actually most societies, even to this day, have honor and shame societies where you do something outside of the community norms and you get shamed and you get excluded from that community. That's kind of an understanding that we're not individual. Right. So it's an understanding that like when your uncle does that, or when Howard Stern does that, or when, you know, whoever does what they do, when the local school teacher puts on a dress and shows up at, you know, like those things, there has to be a consequence to that. And it, you know, the libertarian will say, why? Like, why? You know, he's doing his thing. You do your thing. You don't like the fact that he's wearing a dress. Don't wear a dress. Or like, you don't like that. Like, and unfortunately, like, it's just not a realistic picture of humanity, right? It's not a realistic picture of how children are formed. It's not a realistic picture, I don't see, of even adults. Adults get influenced by bad behavior. So it's, you know, it's just a bad picture of what humanity is. And so that, in my mind, is the fundamental flaw behind libertarianism. It just doesn't work. It's a nice idea. A nice idea. It's not real with humanity, right?
And I want to be
utopian efforts, you know.
So if you listen to our last episode, we talked with Aaron, general editor of the Christian Libertarian Institute, and we brought this very issue up, and he argued, no, communities actually can band together and make rules about their community, and which we would agree with. But I think that his belief around that is very unique in libertarian circles. Most libertarians would argue, like you just did, of this idea of hyper-individualism. And the reason we're talking about it is because the libertarian idea of social interactions has really bled over into conservative and Christian circles. This idea of like, look, man, we can't expect everybody to be Christian and follow God's law. We just have to get along.
Yep. And so, I think what is the right way to do things and the right way to manage a country is to say, what does it look like to be a Christian nation? What should our goals be? Should our goals be that everybody, all the dudes are running around in dresses, nobody knows what gender they are, or should that not be our goal? And I think a good Christian nation would say, that's not our goal. So, and then I think the government should say, okay, well, what, if anything, can we do to help this situation, right? And a good Christian nation might say, you know what, we're going to ban cross-dressing, right? And that might sound authoritarian and horrible, but honestly, like, for most of American history, up until the last 50 years, really, it was illegal for a dude to be walking around in a skirt. It just was. It was, like, illegal. And
Hollywood has done a great job of helping to normalize, right? Like, how many comedy movies have cut, like, since the 60s and 70s? There was one movie, I'm trying to remember the name of it now. It was a Marilyn Monroe film, and the guys pretended to be
maybe or something like that.
What is it? Oh, yes, something thank like you. Yeah, that yeah, one. Yeah. So, okay, yeah, they pretend to be girls.
Which
so
is my favorite. Fabulous. I'm just joking.
But, like, you know what? So, like, the cross-dressing thing has been, you know, like you said, like, we're like, well, you know, just don't go see that movie. And it's like, well, and now here we are. Dudes really think they're girls. And
yeah,
we have convicted rapists and pedophiles transferring to women's prisons. It's insane. So go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. What I was going to say, I should note that people say, well, that's cruel. You know, some people really have gender dysphoria or whatever. A Christian nation would implement laws like that and then also think from a Christian perspective. You know, Jesus says, do unto others as you want them to do unto you. Jesus says that what you do the least of them, you do to me. So then we would think of people that have genuine disorders and we'd figure out how to help them and we'd figure out how to get them counseling and we would care. It doesn't have to be this cruel, heartless society, right? Like, it doesn't have to be this, hey, let's execute all the queers, or like, it doesn't need to be that. Like, it can be a compassionate, genuine, loving society that nonetheless is led by Christian principles, is nonetheless
right. If I was suffering from a mental disorder and I really believed that I was an airplane, you know, I hope that you wouldn't accommodate me and be like, yeah, man, if you know you want to go to the runway and fly off with other airplanes, man, then you know, do you, like, you know, we need to, as a society, accommodate that. You know, of course that's ridiculous, but yet we're doing this for gender.
Right. And so a lot of the objections to Christian nationalism or Christian based laws is that this idea that Christianity is not compassionate, that Christianity doesn't, you know, is going to use and abuse and destroy and, you know, cast out the outsiders, as it's going to be some kind of like the movie Footloose or whatever, where no dancing's allowed and, you know, it's a bummer society. But that's honestly a hatred of Christianity. Like, that's not Christianity. Christianity is a beautiful religion that, in, you know, has so much joy associated with it and has compassion for those that are in a bad place, has love for the weak and love for the minority, and cares about everyone. And yet also has justice, and yet also understands that, you know, not all morality is the same, and yet also has a clear vision of how people should act. And a good Christian nation formulates laws that try to point the whole nation in the right direction. And I think that's the problem, is that right now we have no direction as a country. We have no direction. As a Western civilization. And as a result is getting led, I mean, the absence of religion doesn't lead to absence of organized religion doesn't lead to no religion. It leads to disorganized religion. And
right.
I think that's what you're getting is the pride flag is a religious symbol. Like all this stuff is religious. There's a religious, Ann Coulter talked about abortion being a sacrament for the left. And I think there is a religious element of abortion. Like, so
I was explaining this to my kids really quick. I was explaining this to my kids that like the people who have the signs, like in this house, we believe love is love. Science is real. It's like, I was telling my kids, it's like, that is a statement of faith. That's their profession of faith. That's very much just like you're saying. These are all religious sacraments.
Yeah, it sounds like the Apostles' Creed. Yeah, we believe. And yeah, so it's like very. They posted their, Apostles' Creed on the lawn. But So I think ultimately, a lot of the objections to Christian nationalism come from a smear of Christianity. Christianity is a joyful religion where there's a lot of fun and a lot of beauty and a lot of care and kindness and compassion. And it's not this hard, brutal society. And obviously, like you touched on this a little bit, a big part of how we paint the Middle Ages is just fake, right? The Middle Ages in many ways was a joyful, wonderful time. A lot of people don't realize like, serfs, so like borderline slaves, had more free time than we have today. There was a genuine joy and kindness and compassion within that society. And no, it wasn't perfect, of course. Yeah, there was, there's always places to improve and there's always places things can get better. But it certainly wasn't the cartoon that you see in Monty Python or whatever. It's just it was in many ways a beautiful society. And I think we need to start. Part of what I've tried to do in my writings is to start retelling that history in a way that I think in secular histories a lot of it is told of like, hey, science and reason were on the rise with the Greeks and the Romans. And then there was the Dark Ages where Christianity cast everything backwards. And then there was the Enlightenment that threw off the shackles of Christianity. And now here we are, everything's good. And that's a fake story. It's not true. There's no element of truth to it. It's quite the opposite. It was dark in the days of the Greeks and the Romans. I touched on some of those things. But really, really dark. And Christianity brought a light to the world, and almost everything we're seeing that has been good since the time of the Romans has been Christians making innovations. Christians started the first hospitals. Exactly. Christians ended slavery. Christians stopped infanticide. So like throughout the history of humanity in the West, all those reforms were made by Christians doing it for explicitly Christian reasons.
Like when a traditional pagan practice, if a chieftain or a king died, the property was supposed to go back to the family. And if that family did not like the wife or her kids, they could put them out on the street. And it was the church who imposed, if you claim to be Christian, the Bible very clearly, like, there are so many you read through the Mosaic Law, which, and everybody has these characters about the Mosaic Law without having actually read the Mosaic Law. I challenge everybody to read through Mosaic Law, see how many times God commands. It's the idea that we should take care of widows and orphans is not like, hey, that'd be a nice thing for you to do. We're commanded to do it in the law. And it's because of that, the church in that era, in the medieval era, imposed on the kings, like, look, you widows have rights. You cannot put them out on the street. And that's how we started getting laws. Like, women's rights come from the church imposing God's law on society. So many instances of the church, because of their Christian convictions, making the world a better place. It's just indisputable.
It's almost everything. You look at all the bad things in Rome, and almost everything that got improved was due to Christian reforms. I can point to almost every single example, which in my mind, like people say, well, be on the right side of history with this LGBT stuff, or be on the right side of history with, you know, whatever, feminism or whatever. And my response is like, I feel like there's only one way. History gets told in retrospect, but there's only one way. When you look at history, taking the Christian perspective almost always puts you on the right side of history. Like, I shouldn't even say almost, always puts you on the right side of history. You look at like every time Christians got together and started to make some reforms, it always was the right direction. It always was the right side of history. And so
what wasn't perfect,
but no, not perfect. Yeah. But it was there. They were, Christianity has always been on the right side of history. And so when I look at like LGBT or feminism or whatever, I'm like, okay, well, Christians are on the other side. So if I just following that same principle, I think you're wrong. I think I'm safe being on the right side of history by opposing those things.
Exactly. Exactly. So as we, you know, we usually shoot for an hour, we're getting to be around that time. Let's just kind of chat quickly about like where we want this Let's Build a Christian Nation podcast to go. And I think a lot of it's going to be reiterating points we've made in the past. Like, you know, I don't hear anybody really talking about how limited liability is the scourge of the modern West. Like when people talk about these giant corporations that don't care about their fellow man, that, as you've argued many, many times, that's because the legal structure is set up in such a way that they're not actually fully liable if they make bad or immoral decisions, and in a way that actually promotes them, that it prompts them to make bad decisions so they can make a bigger profit. You know, if limited liability was removed, then people would, corporations included, would be fully responsible for all of their actions.
Yeah. One thing that I learned in business school was that generally speaking, investors are risk neutral with their stock picks. And what I mean by that is, so if you take any kind of decision that you would make, let's say gambling, you go to a casino and you have a machine that say has, most machines have an overall, you bet long enough and you'll lose, right? So you put a quarter in, and let's say over time, you'll lose a penny or two for every quarter, right? So over time, you know, 24 cents you get back for every quarter you put in. Then conversely, maybe a good investment would be is every time you put a quarter in, you get 27 cents back, right? So that would be a better investment. What often drives people to go to a casino is that they're risk seeking. They're willing to risk that 25 cents, knowing that they'll probably get 24 cents in the rare chance that they walk away with a dollar or whatever. So that's a risk seeking attitude. A risk averse attitude. Many of us have risk averse attitudes, right? So if I said, hey, you have a chance of winning, you know, a little bit of money here, but the downside is you could go bankrupt. A lot of us would walk away at that point, even if over time we would win, just that risk of going bankrupt, that risk of destroying your wealth isn't worth it to you, right? Like that's why we buy insurance, right? The insurance company is betting that you'll never get in a horrible accident, so they don't have to pay out $300,000 or whatever, but you're risk averse because that's why you pay for the insurance, because you know that if that were to happen, your family wealth would be destroyed and blah, blah, blah. It'd be lots of downsides. What risk neutral means, as long as the odds show that on a whole you'll make money, you should go with that choice. So regardless of the fact that you might go bankrupt, so like the insurance company actually is risk neutral. They calculate the odds and they say, well, if on a whole, if we have enough customers and they're not, you know, most of them don't get in accidents, occasionally some do, we're risk neutral to that. Corporations as a whole are risk neutral. Investors want them to be risk neutral. So if my corporation on a whole says I'm going to invest in this new medicine, 9 out of 10 times it's going to make us $1 billion, 1 out of 10 times it's going to kill a bunch of people, right? And as a result, we'll be sued out of business, we'll go bankrupt, and we'll cease to exist. But you do the math overall, and most of the time it's a good investment. Odds are it's a good investment. And worst case situation, the investment goes bankrupt. Well, when you have limited liability, when you have a situation where in that bankruptcy, all that happens to the investors is that they lose whatever money they put into that stock, they're going to be risk neutral. And that's in business school, that's what they teach. They're risk neutral. Now, in the contrast to that, if you got rid of limited liability, contrast to that is they'd go to those investors and they'd say, like, how much money did you make off the stock while it was risking everybody's lives? While it was risking, or in the case of the train blowing up, I think we talked about that a few weeks ago, like, while it was risking everybody's lives by cutting corners from a safety standpoint, how much money did you make? And you really should give that money back. And so, and you're like, wait a second, I built my swimming pool, my house. Well, you're going to have to sell your house and sell your swimming pool. Like, that's, in a just world, you shouldn't be able to be risk neutral on a company. You should have the same concern that everybody else has with all their other stuff, which is, as you mentioned, a biblical principle. You should say, listen, I want a company that not only returns a profit, but does so in a way that won't go bankrupt. You know, does so in a way that will protect me and my finances. And I think that's like, that's an example of a biblical justice that our whole society just ignores right now. And I know that was a long explanation, but like, I feel like that's a great picture of where there's a Christian principle that is just being ignored.
Yeah.
But I think we need to rethink. Like, I think we need to relook at that one.
Exactly. Yep. And to see what Lewis is talking about being portrayed very clearly in the Bible, go to Exodus chapter 21, where it talks about the ox owner. And if that ox has a reputation for attacking people and ends up goring somebody, ox and the owner, capital punishment. So we'll talk a lot about how what God's law might look like in a modern society. Yeah, I think you could make a strong argument that our prison system is unjust and unbiblical, and we need to do away with it. There's, you know, capital punishment for things that deserve capital punishment, like rapists, murderers, child abusers. So, like, it's crazy how, you know, if you storm the Capitol, you can rot in prison for however long. You, a child molester, you could be out on probation really quickly. It's so bizarre how easy we are on sex crimes in this country.
Yeah, the prison system honestly is like very screwed up. I don't know. I read a book on the history of the criminal system, but the whole idea of imprisoning people for most crimes is very recent, like the last 200 years. You know, it was always corporal punishment. You got a whipping or you got a beating, and you're put right back out on the street, or just public embarrassment. That's what you see people in those stocks, and that's like just this public embarrassment. So it's like, hey, this guy stole some apples or whatever, and like you just get publicly embarrassed for a day or two, everybody laughs at you or whatever, and then you go back to the world. But this idea of like throwing people in prison for large periods of time, that's a very recent idea. And it came from kind of a scientific idealism idea. So the idea behind the prison system was to reform people. So it was like, oh, we've been, you know, whipping people or whatever. And that's, you know, now we know science. So science should teach us how to fix people. And so the idea of the modern prison system is you bring them in, you fix them, and then you put them back out on the street, and that way they're fixed people. Now we've completely abandoned the fixing years is that it doesn't work. Like, there's nobody who gets fixed. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people get worse in prison.
Yes.
Because they're around a bunch of degenerates and they end up getting worse. So it's not
and now we've privatized it. I think conservatives, we really don't understand like how abominable the modern prison complex is to God. Like, these people rot and they get worse. We don't train them to become a contributing member to society when they get out. So it's no wonder that they repeat offenders as such, and they live in and out of prison. The books I've been reading about theonomy, or the idea that God's law should be used to modern society, they, I think, make a really strong case that actually what God teaches is the idea of restitution. So like that, you know, a thief who steals, you know, in the law, if you stole an ox, you were supposed to get five ox back to the owner. So not only in indemnification, or the idea that you make somebody whole, right? That goes without saying. You were supposed to go beyond that and make them better than when you robbed them or whatever. So, and there have been some cases in our modern society where this has been the case. There, I read recently, it was a while ago, there was a judge, I think it was like in North Dakota, somebody had robbed a local auto mechanic, and the judge, instead of sending them to prison, forced that guy to work for the auto mechanic for X amount of time to pay back whatever. Well, that criminal ended up learning a valuable skill set. And when his time working for that auto mechanic was drawing to a close, that mechanic actually hired him, and that guy ended up having a career as an auto mechanic. Like, that never would have happened if he, like, oh, you did it here. Here's the punishment for the crime. Now you're going to rot in prison. Another example, bankruptcy laws. Like, people moan about the federal student loan crisis, how people at a very young age can end up having hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And they're like, oh, you know, that was stupid, but you got to pay it. You know, you're supposed to. And like, actually, if you read God's law, the idea that somebody can be put under a financial burden and there's no, and without any recourse, is not biblical at all. There's the years of Jubilee. There's all the times when God prompted people to let the poor out of their usurious loans. So a federal student loan forgiveness, and libertarians, I think, make this, this is where they make good arguments of like the federal government should never have gotten. Yeah, exactly. But the idea that those people don't deserve access to bankruptcy is not biblical, is not right at all.
Yeah. And, you know, when you were talking about, you know, the prison system, and I was talking about the prison system, and I said, well, in the old days, it was always corporal punishment. And a lot of people, when I say that, are like, oh my goodness, like, so Christian nationalism, back to the whippings, back to all that stuff. And my answer to that is like, okay, well, I'll tell you what. If you were facing 10 years in prison, and I, as a judge, said, hey, your choice is 10 years in prison or 25 lashes, which would you take? And I don't know about you, Lucas, but like, I know whippings were serious stuff and they hurt bad. And I know you could get sick. I know you could almost die from it. But if my options were 10 years in prison or 25 whips, I would take 25 whips every single day of the year. So like, the idea that it's more cruel to whip than to put somebody in prison for 10 years, I don't agree with. I think it's more cruel to put someone in prison for 10 years. It may be sanitized. It may not look cruel because like, no individual moment is as cruel as the whipping, but the overall action of putting someone in prison for 10 years is more cruel than a whipping. And it's proven by the fact that all we would have to do is make that an option. All we wouldn't, you know, right. We could just say to people, hey, listen, here's your sentence. You got 10 years in prison, or if you don't like that, you can get a whipping, or you can get,
yeah,
you
know,
getting stocks read, in the middle of the square. So
there was a book that came out a couple years ago in defense of whipping, and I didn't read it, but I remember he was making the rounds on like podcasts and making a similar argument, like let's just make it an option so people don't have to sit and rot in prison.
Yeah, I've written articles on that. I don't know if they're still available or not. I should dig it up. But people would take it in a second. I would take it. Like, honestly, especially when like my kids were little, the idea of being away from my kids for a year would just make me cry. Like, I couldn't even imagine being away from my kids.
This is the reality for so many people today.
If a judge offered an option of like a whipping or some other corporal punishment, maybe being in stocks in the middle of the square for a couple days or whatever, I would take that every day of the week, and it would be way less cruel. It would be less cruel to me. It'd be less cruel to my kids. It'd be less cruel. And honestly, a lot cheaper for the state. There'd be so many benefits to it. And and all the judge would have to do is offer it as an option. And like, so all the people saying, hey, it's so cruel, like you guys, Christian nationalists, going back to whippings. Okay, just like make it an option.
No, what's cruel? The three strike rule in California. That's cruelty. Yeah. That's cruelty. Yeah. And you're punishing not just the criminal, that like you said, you're punishing the family. That's all these major problems. We talk about how fatherlessness is is the crux of a lot of our problems today. This is what lends itself to fatherlessness. Fathers being locked away without having a way to get back to their families and offer penance of some kind.
Yeah. Now the kind of flip side of that is like there is that element of there's certain crimes that person needs to be away from society, and you know, like rape, incest, murder, etc. And those, I think, either you have to go to the death penalty or you have to have some kind of prison system for those, because you know you just can't put a rapist back on the street. You know, or whatever, you know, someone that is a pedophile or whatever can't go right back.
But and we do exactly that. We do exactly that today, which is just insane.
Yeah.
All right. We've hit our time goal here, so we'll wrap up. But hopefully you guys got a taste of what different things that Lewis and I are going to try and flesh out. Everybody knows what the problem is, right? Everybody is talking about the problem. Drag shows for kids, healthy children getting physically transitioned through gender affirming care, like all these different things. Well, what's the antidote? Is it secularism? You know, I think secularism is how we got here. The only way that we can get better is through God, through His Word. And so what would that look like? And that's what we're going to be focusing on in our podcast, is trying to flesh out more what living under a Christian nation, what the Christian principles, how does God's law help us to truly love our neighbors and live in a better, more just society?
Yep. That's the plan. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It should be good. More on theme what we've always done, but kind of a consistent thread and a title here. So yeah,
exactly. Like, subscribe. This is the formerly Lewis and Lucas podcast, now the Let's Build a Christian Nation podcast. So like, subscribe. Lewis's book is still available. If you think hallucinogenic drugs are awesome, you should. And then Christians, you know, maybe we shouldn't partake, but we should at least be okay if other people want to. Now, there's a lot of problems with that whole culture, and Lewis does a really good job of breaking down biblically, historically, and scientifically why these psychedelic drugs are problematic and we should not accept them in our society.
That's right. Yeah. And kind of tells this whole theme of Christian Nation, tells it from a drug perspective of like how Christianity and Christian nations interact with psychedelics and drugs throughout history.
Well, like, that's, you know, now that I think about it, like, that's a perfect example of Christian nationalism coming in and making a society better, like the Spanish coming in and being like, you can't just execute people wholesale to your gods. No. Or the British going into India is like, no, you can't take your harems and burn them when their husband dies. Like, no, that's no longer a thing. Sorry. Like, you know, there's so many examples of Christian nations that does that excuse the crimes that Spanish or British empires committed? Of course not. But it's just a statement of fact that they made those the people's lives when those empires came in got better.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah, making the world better for sure. So,
Yep. All right, thanks everybody. We'll see you next week.
all right, thanks everybody.